Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books, and I'm glad you are. Hannah Thurman's debut novel, Mercy Hill, is set in Raleigh, North Carolina, mostly at an under-pressure mental institution. She looks at our changing mental health system and also one of the families, the fictional family, living on the institutional grounds trying to save it. And she joins us now. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's get to the joy first. Tell me what it was like to hold the book in your hand for the first time and see your name and the title and all that work pay off.
Oh, man. I mean, it was great. You kind of get two instances to do that because you get these like soft cover ARCs, these advanced reader copies. And I got those, you know, last summer. And that, I mean, was so significant. And, you know, having that in my hands, and I was like, oh, I think, you know, whenever they send the hardcover book, it'll probably be, you know, nothing special after that. But then like actually having the hardcover, that was really exciting. I got that just about a month before. So that's also like the thing you're waiting for at the last minute. And you're like, okay, hey, it's happening. They've printed them.
So have you been walking by bookstores now looking for it on the shelf?
Yeah. So, well, and mostly, I mean, I live in New York and right. A lot of people commute on and like read on their commute. So like what I am really interested in looking for, and I'm like in every subway car, like, is someone going to be reading Mercy Hill on this train?
Well, they should be because it's a very good book. I enjoyed it very much. But so this is going to sound odd to you, or maybe it won't. When I was reading it, I wasn't thinking it was so much about the mental health institutions or situations in the U.S. as it was about this one particular family. And maybe you'll agree with me. But the reason for that is because I kind of lived this story.
I grew up
in a small town in Illinois, Mantino. And small town, big future has been its slogan for the past 60 years. And it's a farm town. But it was dominated by the Mantino State Hospital. There were more inmates, more patients there, including what they called minimus patients, the ones who were criminals, than lived in the town. I mean, yeah. It was a huge part of my growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was yours as well, right?
You know, so for me, it's interesting. I definitely took, you know, the inspiration for this book from, you know, a mental institution that I grew up near, but, you know, did not have quite as much, you know, I think connection as you must have since where I grew up. Raleigh was a bigger town. It was not quite in the shadow of the hospital as well as you describe it. But it's so interesting to hear you say that because and this is a pretty early stages of like book publicity, I have run into so many people who have stories like yours from every state. Like I was talking to someone at work yesterday and she was like, I grew up in Topeka, and in Topeka, the institute was the Menninger Institute, I believe. And you know, that it closed in 2005. Like I was getting a massage and the massage therapist was like, I grew up in San Francisco and it happened a little bit earlier here. But like my parents talk about the shift and like how, you know, even San Francisco changed after their institutions closed. So I guess it's, I'm so interested to hear that you share this story because I think I kind of like wrote my way into this story and did a lot of research, but didn't really live it. And now I am talking to people, you know, just literally every state, like if someone's talking to me about it in Atlanta and like Virginia that, this was a significant part of American history.
It was a very significant part of my growing up, and reading the book made me rethink that. I mean, so it was the town's leading employer, obviously. My grandmother worked there. A lot of people I knew worked there. The local politician controlled the jobs there. He sold cars. So you had to want a car from him to get a job there. But the biggest impact was that, and the hospital was maybe 3 miles out of town, but people would escape all the time.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. And they'd come into town or you'd see the white cars driving around. And when you're a kid, 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, you're looking at the boogeyman. And there was just a couple of quick stories. One time I was maybe in eighth grade playing basketball on my neighbor's driveway. Mm-hmm. And this man walks up and asks if he can play with us.
Oh.
And it was clear who he was, that he was a patient, right? And the neighbor dad was there too. And he says, sure, you can play. And he goes in, calls the police. The police come and pick him up. Another time my dad was emptying out of school with a bunch of other guys. And there was this one guy who no one really knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured out later he was a patient who had wandered away and just found a crowd and started helping.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's very interesting to hear that and contrast it with, you know, the research I did about the hospital that inspired Mercy Hill. And yeah, once again, to hear, like, it just really does seem like this state by state phenomenon that everyone has kind of like different experiences with that. And so interesting that yours, you know, was such a focal point of a town that, that it was, you know, more residents than
And obviously when it closed, you know, they've tried to revive it with different institutions and they've done a good job, but you know, it's a major drain on the town. That's a smaller town, not like Raleigh so much. But you were driven to this or drawn to this because your mom worked at a mental institution?
So my mom did briefly work at Dorothea Dix, which is the hospital that Mercy Hill is based off of. But I mean, in a much smaller role, like she worked as a speech therapist there for a bit in the 80s. And it was just this like kind of offhand family story that she mentioned, you know, of all the jobs that she had when she worked at Dix, they were the ones that said that, you know, she could even be put up on campus and, you know, that there were people who lived there and lived there with their families. And so that was really the kernel of the story, I think, is that, you know, I mean, my mother, my parents obviously did not choose that for us. But it kind of got me thinking, like, who would be the type of person to say, like, no, this is where I want to raise my family. And then I, you know, kind of built the character of Lisa Cross around that.
And she, Lisa Cross, is the chief psychiatrist, the head of this institution. I'm getting ahead of myself maybe, but what's this book about to you? Is it about this family or is it about the mental health institutions closing in the U.S.?
You know, I hope that it is basically equally about both. I thought a lot about the Poisonwood Bible when I was reading this. And, you know, in that book, it's about this missionary family that's going into sub-Saharan Africa and obviously has this like family struggle that's happening, but it's also kind of against this larger political system of what's happening in Africa, what's happening with evangelical, you know, work there. And, you know, like kind of having one family both represent a lot of things that are happening across the country and across the world, but also having, you know, a real compelling family drama within it. Because I think if you do not have that personal story, then people aren't going to be as invested.
Dr. Lisa Cross is a hard driven woman, you know, with singular focus. Was your mom like that? And have you apologized for revealing her personality in this book?
No, I just have to keep apologizing for telling, for like people thinking that she's like that. My mom is very different. So I have to keep being like, this is something really different. But I mean, it was a job that my mom had, but it's a character very unlike her.
So this institution is facing closure, eventual or withering. Lisa Cross is trying to save it. And on the grounds live her four daughters and her husband Tucker, and her daughters JJ, Caro, Mimi, and Denise. Tell me about the family.
Sure. So it's a family that, you know, the daughters, and maybe I'll start there, have a bit of a collective voice. You know, it's not actually written like that from a POV perspective, but they've grown up in this very isolated, you know, environment. Like, you know, they obviously go out of the grounds to go to school, but, you know, otherwise are pretty kind of stuck where they are. And I think because of that, they kind of initially start very similar and they all, you know, look up to their mother and think that what she is doing in terms of trying to keep the hospital open is just the absolute, you know, top thing to which they can aspire. And I think a lot of the novel is about the growing apart that they do, you know, as they all have to reckon with, you know, whether the closure of the hospital is the right thing, the thing to advocate for, and how, you know, they want to see themselves in the world as adults, not just, you know, members of this set of girls.
Lisa Cross, the doctor, the mom, wants to control what her daughters do, just like she wants to control the fate of the hospital. And so many of us live lives like that. And I mean, I think that's what this book is about. I'll tell you what I think it's about.
Good. No, I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
I mean, in fact, one of the last scenes in before the epilogue is Denise looking across at her mom and then up the hill at the darkened buildings, right? So I think it's this idea that the more you focus on controlling things, the less control you have over them.
Right.
And
yeah.
That seems to me to be what happened with the daughters as well. And now you're the author. You tell me.
No, I think that's, I mean, it's absolutely true for Lisa Cross. I mean, she kind of has succeeded up until a certain point in, exercising a lot of control, exercising very kind of like hard power. And, you know, it's interesting to watch someone who has been successful with a certain strategy, then kind of butt up against the limitations of that strategy. And, you know, are they going to be able to pivot? And she really, except for kind of very superficially, is not. And I think the ability to change directions and to grow is, you know, stronger embodied in the daughters, you know, who initially are just, of course, in lockstep with their mother and then are starting to, you know, kind of explore different thoughts and identities. I think that's a really good, you know, kind of one of the key themes is, you know, about
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Control and letting go.
The four daughters, as you say, grow into very different young girls, adolescent girls, if you will, and then eventually women. I don't know that we need to get into each of them, but they have sort of different ways of rebelling against what their mom does.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Tell me about her husband, Tucker, because he fascinated. He was probably the least of the six characters when it comes to ink, but he fascinated me.
Right. Well, and you know, it's very telling when you asked me that question a few minutes ago, I didn't even mention the dad.
I was going to bring it.
As I was writing the book and you know, juggling a lot of characters, you know, I think I've mentioned in other interviews and talked to other people about the fact that during the writing process, a lot of people were like, it's too many girls. Like, can't we condense them? And so I was very focused on, you know, having these four separate identities plus the mom. So, you know, it's in order to juggle that whole set of characters, you know, it would have been a much longer book to also have the dad have, you know, exactly equal weight. And so it was both that type of stylistic choice as well as, you know, kind of a strategic one to, you know, to focus his scenes on almost in parallel to the way that like he does stay in the background until, and I won't, you know, really get into the spoiler for it until he, you know, also kind of like has this cracking open. So yeah, that was just kind of the thought of how he figured in.
I wasn't saying or suggesting that he was neglected in the, he carries the least ink in the family too, it seems to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. Until he steps up. And even when he steps up, he doesn't step over.
No. Yeah. Like it's smaller and internal. And I think the family can tell like what a big step that is, but even still compared to like the weight of what's going on around them, it does kind of like, you know, not measure up.
Lisa Cross's upbringing was very difficult. Her mother was insane, right? Correct. And,
yes.
And her father abused her, was physically abusive to her. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what drove her into this this role of trying to save this institution. But then her father gets sick, and she takes him in.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about what's behind that for Lisa Cross.
I mean, I think that goes back to what you were talking about just a while before about control. You know, that she has decided that this is going to be this arc of her father's life, that she, you know, had a very tough upbringing with him, but she is going to be the bigger person and, you know, essentially be the winner in this arc by saving him when he gets sick. And yeah, I think that is just very much in line with her personality, that it's not really this act of love. I mean, I'm sure it is intermixed in some ways, but largely it is an act of her taking control over what she thinks is her destiny.
And it's where we begin to see Tucker crack.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
I just want to share one other story with you that I'd forgotten, but, and it's maybe it's self-indulgent, but going back to my growing up in town, and I think reading this book, I'm thinking, were we as citizens there helpful to these patients? Some would be released. There was one guy in town, or I can think of two or three right now, older men who had been institutionalized. They settled into town. Then one guy would walk up and down Main Street, which was all of three blocks.
Yeah.
And would pick up discarded cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was an inch or two on the butt, he would pick it up and smoke it. Wow. And that's just how we knew him. I was a kid.
Yeah.
But you know, after reading this, I'm like, well, I wonder what it was like when what he went home to, or what mm-hmm. sort of support he had in that town, or was he just something that we, or someone we all looked at, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a lot of kind of the questions of even having these institutions and separating people with mental illness, you know, as an other versus, you know, this more modern attempt to reintegrate, you know, people into society and, you know, the very complex issues that brings up.
And so the institutions are closing around the country, in part because pharmaceuticals improved greatly, correct? And then, and in part because it was determined that the patients could probably prosper more in mm-hmm. private life, in sort of, or should say maybe in a public setting, not a institutionalized setting.
Yeah, I think there was and I get into this just a little bit in the book. I didn't want it to be a historical tome, but, you know, this kind of dates back to, JFK and this proposal to, you know, shutter these institutions, but replace them with more community resources, community mental health clinics. But then you get into, you know, more like Reagan era austerity and, you know, not really having the funds to support, you know, any alternative. So, yeah, it's a very multifaceted situation that, right, does include the advent of, you know, antipsychotics, like, you know, I mean, like when Thorazine came on the market, which I think was like in the 20s, and then like atypical antipsychotics that came after that. I mean, not to mention that, you know, there were folks in these institutions who had stuff like epilepsy, which also is like not even really psychiatric, but now is more treatable.
Or alcoholics.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to get back to the story, though. And I don't know, I'm working on my own answer to this question, and I'm interested in yours. In the end, when it comes down to it, whose story is this, Mercy Hill?
You know, it's so funny. I was going back through this like box of stuff that I had when I was writing this novel, largely because someone was asking me what books I used to write the novel, and I couldn't remember any of the names, and I was like, I know they're and I found these notes that I had made over the course of writing the book. And, you know, early in one draft, I just like this clean piece of paper said, you know, this book is the story of my mother, which, you know, from Denise's perspective means mm-hmm. it's Lisa Cross. And then, you know, I'm like tearing through more and more stacks of papers. I get to like later in the drafting phase, you know, journal entry that said, this story is about our family. And so I think it was interesting that it did evolve in the writing from more of an individual focus on the mother at center to a more diffuse, you know, focus on the family and how all of their relationships interact.
I think it's this, well, no, this is a personal, it's an individual question, right? I mean, everyone, and that's what's nice about reading. It's always an equation. You write it, you put it out there.
Yeah, and then you guys have to see what you pick up.
And the readers finish it in many ways. And so for me, because I'm a man, I think this is Tucker's story, which is going to sound, I don't think many people will say that to you.
That's an interesting take. Why do you say that?
Because he started with a great social justice position and stance, and thinking of a couple dinners. And then he ended giving himself up and just going along and be kind, became kind of pathetic.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's what, I don't know. Obviously, he's not a central character, but...
I like that take on it. I'm honestly just so happy that even characters that are not so-called central characters who do not have a lot of, ink on the page are connecting with readers like yourself.
Yeah, in the end, so many of these women did so many things, and he just went along. The name of the book is Mercy Hill. We're talking to Hannah Thurman. And Hannah, reading this book, I enjoyed it all.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when you read a book, there's a moment or a few pages that really, really pull at you or connect with you. And I think you did such a good job with this epilogue.
Oh, good. And,
oh, my gosh. In telling the stories as these women grew into women and wrapping them up and finishing them with a bow for us a little bit. It was just a fantastic way to end the book. Thank you for that.
Oh, well, I'm glad you appreciate that. I mean, I think I struggled with the necessity of an epilogue. I mean, I, always read books and want to know more and want to know, in the future what happens. And sometimes I feel like it's best to not know and to be, left wondering. But I couldn't finish without giving readers at least like a little taste of what came next.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Okay, so were you popular in high school?
You know, I went to a nerd school, and so I was popular, but in the I was on the newspaper staff. I was in the band. Like, I was top of the class in English. So, like, when I say I was popular, I say it within the context of a very academically focused school.
Well, I asked the question because you're going to write next about high school life, the way you sort of wrote about mental institutions here, correct?
Yes. Yeah. I was just working on some of that this morning at 5:30 a.m.
How are you coming on that?
You know, pretty well. Like, I shouldn't even say that out loud, like, knock on wood. But I sold my second book, Thin Skin, to Doubleday in the fall. And it was, I sold it on a full draft. So, my editor looked at a full draft, but it was not quite as polished a draft as Mercy Hill. Like, Mercy Hill took, years and years and years. You're like trying to find an agent, and then you're trying to find an editor. It's been more significant revisions to get Thin Skin, the second book, underway. But I don't know. I was just telling my husband today, I was like, I think things are going to come together this summer, as long as it's not like too crazy with Mercy Hill publicity. But I think I've been able to do both so far.
Well, I'm sorry to get in your way about your next book.
No. I love doing this kind of stuff.
The first book always is, they're interesting to me because the authors carry them with them so long, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they cook a long time. And then the second one, you got to follow up pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I will say, though, like, some of it had been in development, like, as people will soon or in a few years learn, Thin Skin is a bit of a novel in stories. Like, it's not, like, you'd think maybe even a little bit more novel than something like Goon Squad or, like, Olive Kittredge, but it's a little bit more episodic and follows these different chunks of characters. And those chunks did emerge from short stories that I have been working on for some time. So, yeah, you're totally right that, you kind of have your first novel and you're like, oh, it's cooked. And then you got your second one and you're like, let's see what's out there. But what's out there does have some stuff that I've been working on for a bit. So,
well, what's out there now is Mercy Hill. So if you're taking a subway train to New York, read it, hold it up high so that Hannah Thurman can see it. It was great to talk to you. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate it.
It's Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're listening as well. And I hope you subscribe. You can do that on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. It's housed at WGNradio.com, and we're appreciative of that as well. Okay, Steve Bertrand here. Steve Bertrand on Books. You can email me. I'm going to repeat it again. SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm looking forward to the next time.